Welcome to Tech Chat 52. Tonight, effective strategies for advocacy. And we have a great panel of three folks who have been very successful in various endeavors. So we're very excited. And tonight we are using our telephone technology to bring everyone together from Chicago and Massachusetts and Toronto, Ontario. So we're going to begin by introducing our guests and let each of you speak a little bit. First, I'll announce the names here. Kelly Pierce in Chicago, Brian Charlson in Boston or whatever community. It would be outside of Boston. Are you in Boston proper? Anyway, in the Massachusetts area. And David Lepofsky in Toronto, Ontario. So, Kelly, I want to start with you. And what I want to do first is let each of our three guests tell you of some of their accomplishments, and then we'll get into the specifics here of effective strategies that we can use for lobbying and advocating for the things that we want and need. And we'll take some questions later on in the hour. So, Kelly, I want to start with you because I thought it was very interesting looking at some of the things that you've taken on here, working with victims of crime victims, people who have disabilities, among other things. So I'll let you start with that and kind of talk about some of your successes.
Well, that was my day job. That is my day job, actually. I've been doing that since 1994, so it's coming on more than 15 years now, in which I work with victims of crime in the criminal court system. And not just working with them in the court system, but also working with them outside the courts and the community in some of the things and the messes that the crimes have created in terms of advocating with landlords and credit card companies and other folks regarding things, as well as agencies and service providers and benefits providers for people with disabilities and government benefits and all of those things, because many of the people are disabled because of the crime committed against them, or that because of their vulnerability with a disability, they have a magnificent mess on their hands and need some assistance digging out from that situation. But I've also, in addition to that, on my own, private individual, not related to my job in any way, worked with things in relation to banking access, ATM access, worked on that, worked on the policy related to that as part of my job, and as private individual, worked on voting machine access significantly, and working with our election officials to make our voting machines from one of the least accessible to one of the most accessible in the country. Worked on the automatic stop calling system. We joined with a group of people here, objected to a settlement that was entered into, and eventually helped develop with a number of suggestions a high quality audio interface for that system. And so I've done those things, worked on policy with the National Council on Disability in the 1990s, actually, in the early 2000s, in developing a lot of the ideas and a number of the reports that people have seen and advocates have used throughout the country to actually use and leverage ideas that were gathered from people all over and through research into effective solutions. Okay. And started a computer user group with a bunch of other people here in Chicago, in which we've gotten jobs, people, hundreds of people connected to the Internet, which was a big deal in the 1990s, a major way of accessibility and independence that back then we take for granted today.
Yeah, I don't know if you recall where we did. Yeah, I guess there's a little bit of a delay here. I don't know if you recall back in 1999 on the Handy Talk show where we synchronized. We had ViCub in Chicago, right, and ViPace in Pittsburgh, and the ViBug in Boston, and had all groups, and these people came out and were all live on Handy Talk simultaneously, and I thought it was fascinating that people made that much commitment just to learn and interact. It was a memorable experience.
Absolutely, and what's sort of remarkable these days is that the Internet has sort of replaced these sort of local groups for the necessity in many respects for a lot of these local kinds of actions of skill sharing and learning and developing, where we can come together in a different way and do many of the same things.
Okay, well, we will get into specifics shortly, but I want to move on here and introduce David Lepofsky, who forced the, I don't know if forced is the right word, but got the City of Toronto to install automatic bus stop announcements. So that's something we'll go into greater detail since both you, Kelly, and David have worked on that. Plus Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and we'll talk about what that means exactly. So David, go ahead and introduce yourself and talk about your successes.
Hi, it's great to be on this, and I'm a real supporter of this podcast. I think it's fantastic. I I've been a lawyer for almost three decades, and back when I was a law student, I was involved with many other people fighting to get two major changes to Canadian law. One was we didn't used to have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution. Our Prime Minister back in '82, Pierre Trudeau, offered to give us a Charter of Rights, and he included an equality provision, but it didn't include people with disabilities. I and many other people fought and got the Charter of Rights amended as it was being enacted to include equality rights for people with disabilities. We also got disability included in our equivalent of our provincial civil rights legislation. We call it human rights laws. It therefore banned discrimination in public and private economic activity because of disability. That was back in 1982. Fast forward to the early 90s, a number of us felt that those victories were good but weren't good enough, and that we needed comprehensive legislation to require barriers against people with disabilities to be removed, and that new ones had to be prevented. And I had the privilege of leading a 10-year-long coalition that fought a 10-year-long campaign that led to the enactment of two laws in Ontario, modeled somewhat after the Americans with Disabilities Act, but we think kind of better in some ways. The most recent one's called the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. It requires Ontario to become fully accessible to people with disabilities within 20 years of its enactment. We're down to 15 now. And it requires the government to take a number of steps. We're the only Western democracy I know that actually set a deadline by which full accessibility must be achieved, and that deals with barriers facing physical or mental or sensory disabilities, not just physical disabilities. I could talk more about that as things unfold, but just to wrap up quickly, that's in a coalition building and leading role. In my individual capacity, I fought two personal cases against the Toronto Transit Commission. Toronto is Canada's biggest city, and it's as big as most of the big cities in the United States, other than New York or Chicago or L.A. They're bigger than us. We have a population of about 3 million. Anyway, I fought two cases. One, I forced them to announce all subway stops, and then I tried to get them to agree that if they have to announce all subway stops, they also have to announce all bus stops. And everybody else in the world thought that, obviously, if you got to announce all subway stops, you also have to announce all bus stops. Everybody except the Toronto Transit Commission thought that, so I had to fight a second case. I won them both, and now I didn't require the installation of automated technology. I was happy to have the low-cost solution of drivers just calling each stop, but the government decided to spend money, and now every bus, streetcar, and subway car has an automated stop announcement system. To round up my introduction, I'll tell you that well, there are a lot of blind people who appreciate it, but you'd be amazed at how many sighted people also really appreciate those stops. It's a fabulous illustration of how accessibility for us helps everyone. Lots of sighted people have told me that when it's snowing, which it does in Toronto on occasion, like tonight, or it's dark out, which it does every evening, it's sort of hard to see out that bus window, even if you're sighted, and to see what stop you're at, and the automated stop announcements help everyone. Anyway, there's the intro.
Oh, appreciate it. We will definitely come back, because I certainly want to know what full accessibility means. But I want to introduce Brian Charlson, who most recently has had success in coming to a great settlement with MLB.com, Major League Baseball, and I know it started with the Red Sox site for the Boston Red Sox. You have some success with Fleet Boston Financial with both ATM and banking access, and we'll talk about that because people think of ATMs but not specific advocacy when it comes to just banking services. I know you had to work very hard. You had Sun and IBM wanting to adopt their open document format in Massachusetts, alleging it was just as accessible as Word and Office products and was not. And I know you're currently working on doing a comparison of the various talking cell phone technologies, iPhone, Windows Mobile, Symbian, Android, and the LG, which I guess is not quite an advocacy front. But Brian, a very busy man, if you read the many accomplishments here that I've put up on the main page. But Brian, when introduce yourself and talk about some of your, what you would consider kind of some of your highlights.
Sure.
There.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that advocacy was something that came to me when I was a very young person. I became involved in keeping the doors of the Oregon School for the Blind open way many years ago. Just recently, those doors were closed for the final time. But I created an alliance between graduates of the School for the Blind, which incidentally I'm not. I attended some summer sessions there and benefited from it rather indirectly. But we were able to put together a coalition of parents and students, and that we're able to, through that alliance, impress our state legislature over the course of about a decade to keep the school open, in spite of the fact that every couple of years, and the legislature there meets every other year, there was always a bill introduced to close it. So we were able to keep it going for 10 years. I was very pleased to be part of that coalition effort. We also, in the good old days of being a student in college and the like, did a great deal of advocacy to bring to college campuses what we now kind of take for granted, that is the Disability Student Services Office. When I attended a university out at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, the idea of a Disabled Student Services Office really came down to an underutilized closet in the student union. So we've come a long way since those days, and it did take a significant amount of advocacy at the same time I was trying to hold down a full-time program there, getting my degree in political science. My wife and I both moved out here to Massachusetts some 25, 26 years ago, out to from a state of 3 million to a city of 3 million, the greater Boston area, and almost instantly started to see that there was need for advocacy in some other areas in this community I had moved into, one of which had to do with pedestrian safety. So I became a strong advocate for and fairly successful at bringing detectable warnings to subway platform here in the Bay State, as well as now finding them in most curb cut situations. Along with that activity in terms of pedestrian safety, we also were very much involved with creating the standards for audible traffic signals, or what they're called these days, accessible pedestrian signals. We're just lucky that we live here where so much of leading-edge things take place. Boston University, Boston College, so many colleges and universities doing interesting research work that we were able to be part of as testers of the technology and later as advocates for their ubiquitous use in the built environment. Same thing can be said for what you mentioned earlier, that is access to banking. Boston is very much a banking center, and we were able to get the attention of our banking system, both in terms of developing what became the national standard for talking ATM, but also accessible websites for banking. And I guess we might be one of the few households who looks forward to getting bills in the mail, because we've been quite successful at getting vendors of services like our cell phone company, Verizon, to send us their bills in Braille, as well as my bank statement and a number of other bills, all through advocacy. We're also lucky that we live in a city where there's WGBH television. So we were, and I keep saying we because quite honestly I think almost no advocacy takes place by individuals. The most successful advocacy is done first by a core group of individuals who can really work together well to pull these kinds of things off, and also through coalition by groups of people who have similar issues, such as those that Dave mentioned earlier, some of those coalition efforts. So we were able to help WGBH put together audio description as a concept, and then later advocate for the changes in the regulations that made audio description part of the visually impaired and blind community's daily life. We did that also here in access to the theater. My wife just got back from a performance of The Lion King with audio description. In fact, we now have 8 theaters in the greater Boston area doing everything from community theater to Broadway shows with audio description. It's becoming less and less an issue of what is there to do that's accessible, and now it's a matter of choosing between things that are all happening at the same time. I know I couldn't afford to go to all the things that are accessible in my community as a result of that advocacy work. Most recently, I've become involved in this wonderful sport of baseball. And as a baseball fan, I ran into a number of areas that I found quite frustrating, one of which was access to the World Wide Web web pages of baseball. So many of them utilized, I don't want to insult anybody's history, but I'll say non-conventional web page design that made navigating those web pages very, very difficult. So I went and with friends from California and Florida, here in Massachusetts, out in Chicago, fans in all the Major League Baseball cities to get the attention of Major League Baseball, first by putting pressure on our local teams and then by kicking it up to MLB, and very, very pleased that they actually did listen prior to any serious threat of lawsuit. And we've been able to do a number of things that I think are pretty exciting, not just because I'm a fan of baseball, although that was a strong motivator, but also because it sets the stage for other entities to do similar. We started with MLB, but I can guarantee you that NFL, NHL, the NBA, they're all going to be talking to us in the near future about making those sites accessible as well. Kind of fun to be able to mix together what you do for a living. I am the director of computer training services at the Carroll Center for the Blind and Adult Rehabilitation Agency in Newton, kind of a northeast neighbor of Boston. And so I was able to take the technology that I work with day after day and find people who had similar interests and also people who had the passion for this kind of work to work with me. And I think we've been pretty successful up to this point.
Well, very good. A lot of stuff to cover here. We'll see what we can do based on time constraints. Since there is some delay between what I say and what all of you hear, what I'm going to do is throw out some questions and then have each of you just come back and state your name if you like to throw in your 2 cents or comments on that specific topic. I think that'll work better because otherwise we'll end up talking on top of each other. So one of the first things I want to mention is using the internet, because I had 2 successes. Simply by sending an email and getting these sites to deploy accessible CAPTCHAs. So I'm curious, you know, when you take on something like this, how you approach it. Are you using the internet? So I first want to start with that concept, social networking and online petitions in particular. I started one last year specifically for the Amazon Kindle under the belief that this was going to be a really big device and that it was going to affect college students. And, of course, many people got involved in other advocacy efforts came thereafter. So I want to start with that and get comments from each of you about the effectiveness of using the internet and how you would, basically where you would start. What would your approach be? Are you a fan of starting the online petition, which I have found very successful, or do you start kind of setting up a website and then social networking to lobby folks on Facebook and Twitter? Kind of how would you begin an initiative?
It's David Leposky. Do you want me to get started with that?
Oh, please do, sir. Please do.
All right. We have used the internet. The internet was a key player in our winning the disability legislation that we won in 2001 and 2005. This was before Twitter and Facebook, and I openly confess that I am totally inept on those environments, and I got to learn them. It's kind of a generational thing. But we use traditional email and website, and we found that by building a solid email list where I could send it, if I sent an update out, I knew it went out to hundreds and hundreds of people, that they in turn ricocheted it to hundreds of other people, that we were able to get a lot of action at the local level, which when you're lobbying, in our case, the provincial government, which is the equivalent of a state government, and the province of Ontario is pretty huge. It spans 2 time zones. It's got 11 million people. You need to reach a lot of people. So a lot of work into wherever I would ever speak, I would have people sign up, and we built an email list, and it kept growing. And it wasn't just raw numbers. It was people who cared, and they would get other people on, and a lot of them were people or organizations who could then take one of our updates and then ricochet them on. I knew we were successful when I would have people tell me that I got one of my emails from 5 or 6 different people relaying them and relaying them. We knew that we got the government's attention because there were times when I had bureaucrats or political advisors calling me saying, can you please not send that out today? It's 4:30 and people will have to be here all night if we have to answer you. It creates a certain immediacy. The thing that we found that was the most successful is not just sending things out on email, but what you sent out on email. I'm a firm believer in the fast food of political activism. I believe that if you send out a request for people to just say, please get active, they might want to, but they won't. If you send them an email that gives them everything they need, then they will use it, they will modify it, they will put it in their own terms, and they will have a great time with it, and it will create all sorts of action. I'll tell you my thought on petitions, and I never say no to anything. There are things I don't bother doing, but when I say this, I'm not sort of speaking badly of a strategy because other people use them effectively. I find petitions are less persuasive than individual emails because the recipient, if it's a government office or a politician, they're looking to see how much effort the citizen took to convey their message. If it's simply sign a petition, they could sign a petition, not even read it. They could sign it just because they're the brother or the mother of somebody who signed it and said, here, sign here, let's go for dinner. On the other hand, if they take a message and they personalize it, that has a lot more oomph to it. So I'm not saying don't do petitions. I'm saying if you can get people to do other things, if they could take a standard email that you wrote and then add their own paragraph into it and then fire it off, that's all the more powerful. Finally, I'm going to tell you that the Internet is especially important because of the way the mass media works. It is, as you all know, very hard to get a story in the media, especially if it's a national story or, in your case, a statewide or, in our case, a province-wide story. And sometimes you have to generate your own media presence, and the Internet provides a way to do that. And an event that maybe we didn't get covered, we sent out a press release and it didn't get covered in the media, but our press release got around to enough people that it created a certain momentum in and of itself. The Internet really is the alternative medium these days, and it undermines the monopoly of major news outlets who decide yay or nay to a story, and their decision can really make a difference.
Okay, did anyone else want to comment on that before?
This is Kelly Pierce.
I agree.
Okay, well, we'll go with Kelly and
Brian.
So, okay, well, let's do Kelly first and then Brian. Go ahead, Kelly.
Go for it, Kelly.
My success has also been with email, and of course, I'll also tap on the web as well. But with email, I had success in organizing people and filing comments regarding the ATM accessibility guidelines with the Access Board in Washington, because at that time, the regulations were a mess and really didn't address a lot of the key issues that people had. And also really didn't get to the heart of the matter of that they had to really convey that there had to be all information needed to be accessible in an audible form. And as David mentioned, people talked about their stories and their need to access banking in remote locations, outside of bankers' hours, and how it was sometimes, as a blind person, difficult to travel to a branch bank when an ATM is very close and nearby, but it's difficult to access, or you may not want to trust just anybody to use your account or get access to your account. And that caused hundreds of people to file comments, very personal comments, very very compelling comments, and to an extent that it was one of the five most commented issues that occurred. That was around 2000 when those were filed. And it certainly got the Access Board's attention, and that, of course, of the banking industry as well. And so that was very effective. That got the message out. That was 10 years ago. Certainly, one of these days, in terms of the web, I would say, is many people get in touch, or they're getting into things, and every organization these days has a website, big ones and small ones. And what I find a lot is people end up calling places or wanting to get into things or wanting to get started on something, or they have an issue of one kind or another, and yet there's information already online on the web, easily locatable, that already talks about it or addresses it, or at the very least gives some basic information about it. And I'm finding many people fail to just look at basic information up and get a basic understanding of the organization they're approaching or the topic that they have an interest in.
Okay, let me call on Brian, and then I want to get a little specific about what that email, the initial email to get the fires burning, if you will. But Brian, I want your comments here about Internet strategies.
We've all spoken somewhat about the importance of getting the media's attention, and a conventional press release sent out electronically might get two or three snowflakes together to start to roll down the mountain. But what really makes this work well is when you link it to other things. That's when you really get the high hit rate for what you've put up on the web, whether it be in a blog format or a Twitter format or on your Facebook page, whatever. When you link to other things of similar concept, and then you get the benefit of not only that direct linkage, but the link to the link to the link. When the media goes out to look for experts on your subject, you need to have your name out there. It's much harder for them to chase, or for you to chase them down, than it is for them to chase you down. That's resulted in, over the years, in me getting on CNN and on the front page of the Boston Globe here, or for that matter, in a variety of other electronic formats like television and radio over the years. It's all a matter of linking what matters to you to what matters to others, so that those searches, if you were to search right now for Major League Baseball in Blind, articles that I wrote and articles that I referred to in my Twitters, et cetera, caused them to contact me and come to my office for that all-important interview to make your issue a major issue. We did that with our blog site that we did when my buddy Rick and I went out and saw eight games in 8 days in 6 cities, using access technology to do the navigation and just plain enjoying baseball throughout the whole process. It really does make a difference. I bet you when you did research on the three of us as potential guests on your show, you did a little bit of web research and blogging or going out there and Googling each of our names. I bet you came up with quite a bit of information. You need to find a way to make you appear as the expert if your issue is going to get any press time.
Very good point.
I might also say that while electronic text does a good job, sometimes you got to go back to the old school. I'm put in mind of an effort we had up here in Massachusetts when the governor decided that the best way to force the legislature to raise taxes was to cut programs for those with disabilities. We weren't too happy about that because it meant that he cut our Braille and Talking Book library budget to under $800 for the year. So we took about $100, went out to a printer and printed up some of the little cards that you put in the plastic boxes to send them back. You know, you normally flip it over and it's got the return address to the library on that side. Well, we had people put replacement cards in, and we mailed 20,000 talking books to the Speaker of the House of Representatives that way. Sometimes you have to be creative on how you get people's attention.
Exactly. Good point on the blogs, because now blogs are given priority attention on Google. So for folks who maybe aren't getting the gist of what you're saying go ahead and create a blog and write articles about what you're interested, what you're advocating for, and a lot of links, so that there's a lot of cross-referencing, because when you link to other entities, they'll oftentimes link to you and you get in the blog roles and you get this whole kind of cross-promotion thing going on. And plus, David talked about the compiling the email lists of like-minded people who share your goal and interest and writing individual compelling letters. It's just been some very insightful information that you've disseminated here. And we're already halfway through the show, and I'm only on question number five. But sorry, go ahead, Kelly.
Well, remember, Mike, the top-rated blogs these days have a bigger readership than the top-rated news shows on major television networks. So that's what people fail to understand when it comes to blogs. They're just not this ethereal thing that people generally don't pay attention to. The readership of these blogs, on the top blogs, of course, is bigger than that of the major news programs on the major broadcast.
Good point. David, you had a thought, sir.
Well, it's David here. Let me just add another couple of things that spin from all of this. One is that, you know, when you do this kind of social justice advocacy, you don't have a lot of money to do it. In fact, my coalition doesn't have a budget of anything. We do this as volunteers or with the support of voluntary community organizations that we really appreciate. The beauty of the Internet is it's the poor person's printing press. You know, you can send out an email, and you don't even have to pay for a single postage stamp as long as you paid for your monthly Internet service provider. The next thing is it's the most accessible way to reach people. I mean, one of my key collaborators in my coalition throughout these years, I've had many key collaborators, but one was a gentleman who happens to be deaf. Now, he doesn't know Braille, and I don't know sign language, but we can have full planning meetings and conversations on email with nobody helping us. I can communicate with people who are deafblind. I've got all, I mean, it is the most accessible way to communicate. It's the least expensive, at least for those who have the Internet. Obviously, those who don't, that's a huge problem. But the other thing that's significant for people to understand, when you do this kind of advocacy thing, you know, we're all talking about our victories, but underlying every victory is about a million failures that I'm sure we've all had. We have press conferences that never got coverage, letters that never got answered, phone calls that never got responded to, and all of them were probably just as newsworthy and just as juicy and just as meritorious as the victories we're talking about. And the Internet actually helps you get a lot more bang out of your victories. In other words, if I give an interview on a small-town radio station in the middle of rural Ontario, nobody in Toronto hears it. And, of course, those are the people who live in Toronto, like me, think Toronto is the center of the, not only the universe, but the multiverse. And but on the other hand, if you do an interview in a smaller community, if you can simultaneously stream it onto an MP3 recorder and then upload it to your website, then all of a sudden all sorts of people who could not hear the actual radio broadcast can hear it on your website. Same with news articles. I'll just, a very quick anecdote. I use Google Alerts very aggressively. And when I've been fighting my case against the, after I won my case against the Toronto Transit Commission to get bus stops announced, we were trying to get other municipalities to obey the same ruling. And there was some resistance. And I might get a Google Alert one morning about a column in some local town that you might not have heard of, like Belleville, Ontario, or Sarnia, Ontario, where some city councilors started railing against this as an unreasonable intrusion to have to announce all bus stops for blind people. I got the Google Alert hit me right after their story went up on the internet. I could then pick up the phone, call the reporter who wrote it and said, "You want a response?" And they were quite happy to talk to the guy who won the case in Toronto that got it started. And that generated a series of articles in the newspaper, in the local paper, which in both cases got the decision, the retrogressive decisions reversed. I then posted all of the stuff that happened so that people around Ontario involved in our cause we're aware about the battles in Belleville and Sarnia, Ontario. And you can go to our website that's got a link for this podcast, AODAalliance.org. And under the What's New page, if you scroll down, among the things will be those articles. So small victories and that might otherwise never see the light of day can be perpetuated and can be communicated to a lot of people if you've got an effective website.
Good point. And timeliness is a factor there as well. You have to act quickly. You get that press coverage. You need to respond as you do quickly and pick up the phone or shoot off an email and stay active with it. I do want to move to Kelly and talk very quickly about where you were talking about going into educational facilities and finding the setting up appropriate access technology based on the needs that this particular student had, or finding quality trainers, because I too often see people will recommend only one or two solutions that they know of because some of these quote-unquote professionals don't take the time or interest to research of all the technologies that are available. And that's one of the things we really strive for at the Serotalk podcast. So I'd like you to talk about that and someone who's either going into an educational environment or just trying to find quality training. How do you assemble a group of knowledgeable people that or just advocate for, you know, you want maybe a different technology that someone's pre-decided is best for you? So talk about your work there.
Sure. Well, first, I wrote a whole series of articles on this on the whole.
I've got all those up on the page. If there's anything in particular here, these are links. I think.
So people can check all those out. It's hours worth of reading, actually, when it all gets down to it. But in terms, the main key idea here, though, is that people must think in terms of being in charge of their own destiny. Often we sort of outsource that to other people and not actually spend the time to think about what kind of learning style might work for us. Sometimes it's an in-person trainer. Other times it could be a tape. Other times it could be reading some kind of manual and getting that and learning about those resources through a service like Recording for the Blind or a Bookshare or something like that. So it's important to think through and think about what resource might work, and sometimes several resources could work at the same time. What I also find, and in terms of working with a student, he approached me and when I was with this user group in the 90s, and I actually did the research, looked it up. He wasn't as familiar with it as I was. And together we filed essentially a complaint with the civil rights office on his campus without having to go through some sort of legalistic process, but raising that issue inside that institution in a more formal way, and then that actually resulted in significant change at his institution to the point where now computer labs are accessible, and they actually have an employed person that focuses on technology access. So in that sense, it's really doing the research. What does the law require? And there's often thinking about what policies are already out there and existing. and seeing how do those policies apply to my current situation. And that's what essentially I did with that student in talking to him about the existing policies regarding accessibility and civil rights for people with disabilities and what currently was the prevailing thinking on a lot of those things and explaining that to the school officials. I don't believe they fully had understood those issues in the way that we ended up doing and helping that understand. But in terms of choosing it, finding a trainer and so forth, what the key there is, Mike, is one has to put a team together. Doing this on your own is one person's ideas is not as important as finding several other knowledgeable people's ideas. Maybe it's someone who knows you well. It could be someone who's a neighbor who's a geek and someone who works in the technology industry, perhaps. It could be a teacher in a class that you have. Or it could be your supervisor. It could be several other people who have a different understanding of your situation than probably what you do yourself, and maybe looking at it from a slightly different angle from you do, from what you're actually doing. And that different understanding can actually help look at the problem and help craft a solution that's probably a lot more comprehensive than what any single individual could probably put together on their own. So that's where it comes in. And also the other thing to realize, Mike, in looking at a solution and finding a trainer, and there's a lot of ways to find trainers, from just asking around to looking at different models of where that could be done, for everything from your own community to online to different methods of doing that, trying them out, seeing what might work best for yourself. But ultimately, it's really considering various options and finding out what is the best fit for you, and realize that some things are not about what you think they are. They may not be involved advocacy. We talked a lot about internet resources. To use all those resources requires a fair bit of time, spending the time to learn how to use them. So that's the other thing to consider with all of this and training and other things. There's no magic person out there that's suddenly going to put their hands on your shoulders and convey this knowledge to you. It's a lot of work to master this stuff to a level where it can be extraordinarily effective.
You're right. A lot of it is self-initiative, and that's one thing that we...
Mike, I'd like to...
Okay, Brian, sure, because I want to, before you comment, I just want to also pick your brain, if you could throw it in, your thoughts on education. I know two people that probably will ask questions, and we're going to take questions very shortly, but your thoughts, their concern, like if they're not allowed to take their tests in the room, and basically their recourse when they're not getting satisfaction from an individual instructor or their resource center. But go ahead with your comments.
Two things. One is that Kelly was talking about the fact of the matter being that individuals can bring a lot to any kind of problem. But what's most effective is when it's a group of individuals bringing their particular expertise and those coming together into what is definitely more than just the sum of their part. I also think that it's important for people who are thinking about advocacy to remember that not all advocacy has to be of a national scope or a statewide scope. Advocacy may be an individual case that needed just some championing at a given point in time. We have a woman here in Boston who established a program for disadvantaged blind youth in one of our more poverty-stricken communities. And that was something one person did with her particular passion. She's not trying to change the world. She's trying to help change the lives of a half a dozen young people and doing a marvelous job of that. I'm going to go back to your question about testing and education and those.
Okay, while you do that, well,
if I could advise,
hold on just a second. I'm going to let folks know that I have opened up the forum for questions so they can go ahead and submit text questions, and I will read those to you. So go ahead with your comments on the education.
Sure. It's very, very important when you're experiencing any kind of difficulty with any bureaucracy to write it down. Trying to make your point orally. Trying to say, well, he said this or she said that or I said this or I said that just doesn't make it when it comes to advocacy. You have to document what's going on. If you've been denied access to reasonable accommodation and taking a test, if you have found that a member of the town council has turned a deaf ear to a problem you're having with bringing accessible pedestrian signals to a particular intersection. The best way to make your case is in writing. Document what's going on, both the positive and the negative. Whenever I have an acquaintance who has been denied some service that they feel that they should have received, my first question is, did you make the ask in writing? Did you require the response in writing? Because when you start to appeal decisions, you need documentation.
Excellent point. Document, document, document. And that's, you know, I'm coming from the working in the Better Business Bureau. You need to document who you spoke with, exact dates and times, the exact outcome, like you said, positive or negative, exactly what was said and who said it. Because without that, there's no track record. It's he said, she said, and it's just really not effective. You're not going to get anything accomplished. Again, we'll take text questions. I can't enable voice. I was hoping to do most of these through the text portal just to expedite. And we have our first question. I will read it to you here. Here's a question from Jess, what about recording the actual dialogue? Well, don't you need consent for that? I'm going to ask David, and of course, it's a legal question. I don't know if that differs between the U.S. and Canada, but I think if you're going to record someone's voice, you need their consent, right? So,
well, I can't. It's David here. I can't advise you on American law, but I, as a courtesy, will do that anyway, whether or not I'm required to. Because let me just explain that I think that. Being honorable in one's advocacy efforts is really important. Having credibility, sticking to the facts, making sure you state things fairly, that you don't overstate things, that you don't misstate things is really important. And frankly, I think it's important not to I don't use trickery. I've always tried to be as above board and honorable as I can, and I encourage others to do that. Now, in that regard, it is perfectly okay to ask if you're going to an important meeting if, for example, you can record it as an alternative to taking notes. If you get permission, then that will be quite helpful. Just while I've got the microphone here for 1 minute, and because I know time's going to run out, I just want to make an offer to people listening. If you want to learn more about our activity in trying to get our accessibility legislation passed and implemented, you can sign up to get our email updates. We don't send out a lot, and it's not a listserv. We don't have back and forth with people chatting. It's just us sending out updates. The email address will be up on the website for this dialogue after, but I'll tell you what it is right now. It's aodafeedback@gmail.com. AOD, like Donald, A, feedback, that's one word, @gmail.com. If you want to go to our website, it's AODA Alliance. That's my coalition's name. AODA stands for the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, and our coalition is the AODA Alliance. We're aodaalliance.org. You can go see the story of how we've been fighting this battle. And the last resource I'll offer you is, if you want to hear about our story, at least the battle from 1994 to 2003, which is not the full story, but it's the first chapter. I've written an article called The First Chapter. It's long. It's published in a law journal, but you need neither to be a lawyer nor a Canadian to understand and appreciate it. It can be read by non-lawyers, by non-Canadians. If you write that email address and say, send me the history of your Disability Act movement, I'd be happy to send that article along. It's in MS Word, and it's completely accessible.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I've put up a link to your website. It is number 7 in our resources here, so the folks can follow up there. Again, any more text questions? We would certainly welcome those.
And in regard to the recording, in terms of some of the things you're doing as part of advocacy, for example, When I am asked to review an audio interface, I record my interaction completely with that myself, not necessarily an important meeting necessarily, because often people are a little, at least in this town, edgy when it comes to recording. But when it comes to like evaluating an interface, or something along those lines. Absolutely, it's virtually impossible to produce an 8 or 15 page report without being able to go through second by second a recording and identifying a lot of the issues.
Yeah, I think the big thing is to make sure that you're public about it. Make sure, because that was just a very general question, that you don't mean you're walking in with one hidden in your coat and no one knows you recorded it and come back and go, well, here's a transcript of this conversation that you didn't know that I recorded. So I think being up front. Let's look at the next question here. Yeah, exactly. Question from Rob. He asks, okay, I'm sorry, I can't help you there, Rob. I don't know why you would not be hearing audio. Yeah. Go out and come back in again. But if you hear no audio, he can't hear me say that. But anyway, any other questions from folks? So is radio, TV, and print media worth the effort? Or have you pretty much gone to internet? Or for that matter, one of you mentioned using telephone and written letters. Is that still an effective strategy? Or have you pretty much gone all internet? Or has anyone found success with using the old-fashioned letter writing or telephone calls?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The internet is one medium. It is not the only one. It isn't even, and you got to use everything at your disposal. If you can't get coverage from a regular, if the newspapers aren't picking up your story, write a guest column and ask them to take it. And frankly, I find guest columns are great because then I don't ever have to worry about being misquoted. The only guy who's going to misquote me is myself because I'm controlling the words. Call-in radio shows. Call-in talk radio shows are fabulous. And frankly, if we can get our topic on, then I send out an email and encourage other people to call in. And we can populate a show with a bunch of calls that way. So all of that. Conventional letters, I suspect politicians and others will take more seriously a handwritten letter, if it's from a sighted person, or a typed letter that shows an individual effort, not just somebody who's copied out something someone else told them to write. They will credit that with more. And ultimately, I still believe the best effective persuasion is to be face-to-face with someone anyway. So if I'm trying to persuade someone, what I ultimately want to do, these are all means to ultimately try to get in the room with the decision-maker face-to-face and try to convince them that what you want them to do is a really good idea.
Okay, on that note, then what about...
Go ahead.
I'll tell you what, let's hold right there. We got a lot going on. I got a question. I want to see what this is here since we're running out here. Okay, well, I think that's kind of been addressed, Jess. He asked about the effectiveness of online petitions. And again, he said it works, but they would still give priority to creating an email list, which is so easy to do, and populating it with the right information and clearly outlining the cause and who the appropriate people to contact would be. But my question would be, having to do with, if you get that chance to do a face-to-face presentation, what do you bring in? Do you bring in a group of people, and what number of people? You trying to fill the room, or are you strictly trying to get an opportunity to show some kind of PowerPoint or some effective handouts or just a list of letters? Or what about a face-to-face presentation when you're meeting, going before your city or county council or something on that level?
Brian, I've spoken before everything from congressional hearings down in Washington, D.C., to my little town council or the school board. And I'll tell you that a letter is every bit more valuable to them if they can associate a face with the name penned at the bottom of the letter. It is very much worth taking that extra effort to get the face-to-face with the decision-makers that have some control over your issue. I also think that bringing people into the discussion who aren't overly polished. I worry about all of us starting to sound like too much of a professional advocate. It's much more effective to bring in, like we did this past weekend down in Washington, D.C., meeting our congressional delegation from Massachusetts, to bring in somebody who has re-entered the workforce after getting effective rehabilitation training when you're trying to advocate for continued funding of specialized services. Not to just go as a professional or somebody who has a very polished presentation, but to bring somebody in who can stumble over their words a little bit, get a little bit emotional about what they're talking about because it's so meaningful to them.
Okay,
involved who are not professional advocates.
Okay, and on that note, I got a question here from Byron who asked, and he says, are any of you involved in Toastmasters or any sort of public speaking class? How do you develop your speaking skills so you can better convey your message?
Ryan here, I was a member of Toastmasters on the debate team in high school and into college, and an active member of the Toastmasters club for about a decade or so.
So you would encourage
that? Certainly does help.
Right, if people
have
challenges.
But nothing helps more than doing it and then doing it again.
Or recording yourself, listening to yourself, or getting other people to critique you who will be honest. And that may be the challenge, getting someone who will be honest. But yeah, the Toastmasters, where you're all there with before the same goal. Okay, go ahead. Kelly, was it?
Before I go to an important meeting, like as which Brian is suggesting, I spend days studying it, considering what people might ask me, thinking about the responses I might provide, thinking about the questions that would be asked, and some of the issues that will be raised, and being prepared to fully respond and answer to many of the issues that would be broached, and thinking about some of the scenarios that might arise, and being prepared and confident to respond to some of those things. So a lot of it's preparation as well, and feeling comfortable in that arena.
Knowing your topic. Okay, we're down to 3 minutes. I want to give each of you, unfortunately, 1 minute to give your final thoughts. Any quick words of wisdom? Maybe it's a website. Maybe it's just something to leave our folks thinking about. And I'm going to start with David.
The best, most effective advocates are often not the polished advocates, but the down-home, plain, ordinary, average folks who aren't necessarily the most articulate. They're not necessarily the most dressed, but they're the most sincere, as long as your arguments are good. And when you want to decide what arguments are good, you're not going there to persuade you. You're not going there to persuade your friends and family. You're going there to persuade the decision makers. So what you got to do before you go is put yourself in the heads of the politician or the corporate executive or whoever you're going to meet with and say, if I was listening to this, what would be my worries? And then be ready to answer their concerns. So you got to, it's the hardest thing to do, but you got to think like the person you're trying to persuade and get out of your own headspace. And that will make you come up with the most effective arguments. I want to thank you for inviting me to take part in this, and I commend you for doing this. And people want to learn more about what we're doing up here in Canada. AODA feedback at gmail.com. Get in touch with us. We'd be happy to hear from you.
Very good. Kelly, your final thoughts tonight, sir.
Well, my final thought is consider your passions. And I think we all have them if we think deep and openly about those and pursue those. Those often lead to the best kinds of advocacy and the best efforts, whether big ones or small ones. And I think that's how I got started in all this. And a lot of my little issues have turned ultimately into very big ones. And that's where I think the advocacy efforts that have lasted years or maybe decades have given me that kind of motivation and drive to keep on going because I've been passionate about the things that I've been interested in.
Very good. Brian, your final thought tonight, sir.
Advocacy is a personal commitment to some task, some issue that you've come in contact with. I would really recommend that people get involved in things that affect them personally, but also take a little chunk out of some issue that doesn't affect you personally, but where you know the individuals affected are not going to be their own best advocate. An example would be recently working with people in our state penitentiary who are blind to make sure that they get access to talking books, make sure they get access to people to help them through the legal process, making sure that children have appropriate advocates for them when they're dealing with their educational needs. Make that mix and match. A little something for me and a little something for you will make you feel good about what you do and, in fact, will make the world around us a better place.
Great thoughts. I thank all of you. We just scratched the surface. I hope we can do this at some point down the road in the future and come down and maybe we'll get even more specific so we can get into the nitty-gritty of some issues. But I thank all of you for your great insights. And, of course, email addresses are available as well as some individual websites. And if any of you, either our three guests or those listening, would like to email me any other resources to include in this page, we can do that. And it's dynamic so that anyone that views this presentation in the future will see the updated link. And we'll put them at the end so they don't conflict with any existing numbers that I may have mentioned. But we thank you for your participation. This is what we're looking forward to in 2010, giving you the information so that you can go out and make the changes to make the world a little better place for yourself and for others. So until we meet again next week, this is Michael Law for Serotalk. Stay connected and stay directed.